length, the generation and the dumping of waste in places where it should not be, it's a proactive role. It's not in this case. The whole idea of EIA is to be proactive and to prevent something from going wrong in the first place and not then to remedy it afterwards. With regard to the export of waste, there are international conventions that regulate the movement of such waste, and that is a totally different debate as well, with specific policies and legislation and international protocols that are applicable to that, of which I have no mandate to speak. But you, there are some of these other institutions and that are in a better position to address that question. What I can say is, if there is an application for such a or a need for such a proposal, it will have to be evaluated within the existing policies and legislative framework.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fori. I think there's another round. I can see Mr. Novo, and Ms. Kuena, and Asama. I can say something about it.
Thank you. It's just a follow-up. Actually, I am a bit surprised that the presenter really seems to reiterate what is exactly, if it's about environment, if you are saying that you only look at, your role is that you must only look at where, say, the radioactive material is stored and so forth, that you are narrowly responsible for that. I don't think that is the truth. I happen to know the nuclear industry very well, how it operates, and an environmental assessment activity associated with that. For instance, if a ship from Europe is passing through South Africa to Japan or India, that's an environmental question if it is carrying radioactive material. And I think that you are less involved with environmental regulators in there. I just wanted to clarify that.
That's important. As I said, members, this is the last round, so I recognize you as well. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Can you introduce yourself?
Ron Shaikh from the Fire Technology Group. I do not believe that, or let me say, rephrase it differently, I do believe there are legislation for movement of nuclear waste and all other types of chemicals in South Africa, for South Africa. So yes, I would agree with what the presenter said, that internationally it is regulated internationally. But what's happening in South Africa, any bulk transport of chemicals, but there are certain final saying what chemicals are in that bulk container. So if it overturns on the road, that either the parties would know what sort of chemicals to use to stop a fire or to clean it up. And for that reason, I think that the environmental affairs must come forward with some sort of apology as to how to protect the environment. They should know what any other department is specified, and they must be finally in charge of it.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Perhaps when I asked the question, it appeared very superficial. When I said it was a forum, it was not just a forum for the sake of a platform in a physical sense, but it was for interaction. When you see, we are lawmakers here. There are three committees here. There is the Environmental Authority, there is Science and Technology, and there is the Department of Minority Affairs. Now, we make these laws, and then we need to have feedback. Now, we are lawmakers, and then the laws go on, and then you guys are the implementers. Now, when I ask the question, is there a formal meeting? You are not just for the sake of a formality, yes, we are meeting, and the diary, and the date, and things. That's not the question. The essence of that question is, when you meet, as implementers of the laws you make, do you find a disjuncture, do you find some problems there that require adjustment? So that the issues that are raised now, that have been raised now by a member here, can be overcome so that we can have a coherent, we are a legislature. We can, that the laws we make must not conflict. There should be a partition of lawmaking, that committee, that department, etc. There should be interministerial, interparliamentary, and interdepartmental, coordination and conference in order that this very difficult, this phenomenon called the environment, which is an envelope that used to be the blanket that God has given us, should not be harmed, right? Now, so one should not adopt that issue of partitioning and things like that. That's my role, and that's it. And then if other people went around, if they are comfortable elsewhere. Because only one planet, and it's important how we actually, make sure that now we don't actually harm it, because once it's destroyed, it cannot be, you cannot ask the customer for God to make another planet. So that is the essence of my question. Masoma?
Chair, the sense is coming from the same angle. Just for me, in addition to formulating an EIA that does the job it's supposed to do, I imagine your department must have a very deep understanding of the possible problem areas and how they can impact on the public. I just wondered what particular criteria would he supply from an environmental side to decide whether the risks are acceptable or not.
Thank you, Chairman. Only what I want to ask Mr. Fosi. One would assume, maybe for this assumption is wrong, please correct me, that GIGS is a custodian of the environmental sustainability of our country. That is, your principal mandate is to secure the environment of the country. If that assumption is correct, then what is your view on nuclear power? What is your view? What's your take on it? Is it the right thing? Is it the wrong thing? What's your take on the debate? Because you cannot say that you cannot have a take, because there are environmental implications. Some of them are overthinkers. You can hear us about that or not. So I was hoping that the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism would have led to us and posed the question, raised the issue, and at least inform us what is your take, how are you approaching the question of the environmental implications of the use of nuclear power? That for me is the question that I would have wanted you to talk to us about, and I hope that you can at least enlighten us on that. Thank you. Is the last one.
Thank you, Chair. You see, my concern is real. I'm scared because today we are faced with global warming. And this is due to what we do as humans, not actually thinking in terms of the repercussions of what we're about to do. Now we are about to create a Frankenstein, but we don't seem to have clear ways of containing this Frankenstein when he gets crazy. And that's what I'm scared about. So if you would tell me and give me some assurances as the environmental department to say that no, we do have means and ways of containing amorphous Frankenstein, that would give me a little bit of some comfort. That's what I would really like to hear. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I will do my best to answer all of these questions, but I must reiterate, I'm not the expert, and most of these questions are on the field of expertise within other government departments. Look at the one of the our role in the process and the authorizing of nuclear movement of nuclear material.
it is true that we do have a role in that regard, and we execute that role within the context of the applicable international conventions and policies in that regard. So it is true that there are lots of different pieces of legislation outside of the EIA process that is responsible for the, such activities. And we are consulted in that regard, and we do give our opinions in such cases if it is relevant. It is also true that the movement of nuclear material, which is a hazardous material, will be regulated in terms of more than one piece of legislation. There is a policy on the transport of hazardous materials, which is the mandate of the Department of Transport. We take cognizance of this, and we, if we authorize anything that is also listed in terms of our legislation, we coordinate with those other departments to ensure that there is no conflict between us. But we are not the sole controller of all of these things. That's why I said right at the beginning, we have a role to play, but we are not the main role player in all these cases. In most of these cases, it is a coordinating function between the different institutions that have executive responsibility. And there are structures within which we execute these functions, but we steer the process within the policy of all the other individual departments. I'm sorry if I oversimplified the response to the coordinating function. It is true that there are these processes are vastly different. Our process is provides for a single authorization at the end of a long drawn out process. Whilst, as you are no doubt aware, the National Nuclear Regulator issues authorizations as the process go along. They've got different stops within the process where permits are issued. And it is a totally different approach towards to what we have. It is not for us as officials to try and amend their legislation. We must just make sure that our legislation and their legislation are coordinated as well as is possible within the means that is allowed for it by the different regulations. And this is what we try to do with the establishment of that committee. It is not always easy because, like I said, the time frames differ, and in the nuclear process, they can get some permits already at very early stage, while ours only comes very late. If Parliament can assist with smoothing that out and making it easier, or surely we as officials will appreciate that. I don't know if it is possible. But thank you. The matter of the different criteria that's being applied in evaluating such applications, this is what the EIA process provides for. If a specific issue is identified and it is analyzed by the experts, be that whatever issue it is, and we as environmental departments evaluate the reports, and those reports are also available in the public domain, we rely on the expertise and on the experts that assess these affect and address these issues, and if it is not done adequately, it is, those documents are open and freely available. So if there is something that is not correct, there is opportunity for that to be picked up, even if we don't pick it up ourselves. If it is areas where we don't have the competency in-house, then we contract other experts from outside and even in some cases from abroad to assist us in evaluating those impacts, to make sure that what is presented in the studies is in fact correct and that we can believe it. But if it is matter of nuclear safety, we do not duplicate that, because that is the role of the National Nuclear Regulator, and the National Nuclear Regulator has got its own process and also a process for involving the public. In that regard, they provide for hearings as part of their process. And we do the fact that an EIA is being done for an application does not eliminate that part. We don't take that part away. That will still have to take place at the appropriate time in terms of that appropriate piece of legislation. Our role as the custodian of the environment, we implement the different policies of the different departments. Nuclear policy is not our mandate. And if the Minerals and Energy decide that nuclear power is the way we should go, then we accept that. If there is opportunity for us to participate in the debate, we will do that as with any other policy process in the country. But it is not for us to have a conflicting policy. If we do have differences, then those differences are addressed in the policy formulation process. By the time a policy is accepted as government policy, then we execute our function within that context. And that is also how we handle the current applications in this regard. The last question. I don't think that we as a government department will allow something to be established if that thing has the potential to become a monster, as you used the example. That is why we have that process to look thoroughly into this proposal and to identify if there is, to make sure that there is no hidden aspect, that it's not just something that looks good for the short term, but that is going to be cause a problem later on. That's one of the reasons why we do impact assessments, and impact assessments must also look at the longer term. And it is not always easy, and sometimes we don't have all the knowledge, but in those cases we operate within the policies applicable at the time. You have mentioned the concern of climate change. That is also one of the aspects that we take into cognizance. The contribution of different options of power generating electricity towards global warming is a major concern. And that is also something that will, or that is of relevance in the formulation of the energy policy and whether we as a country should go the nuclear route or not. But like I said, that is the decision for DME.
not for environmental affairs.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Foley. One hope that hopefully in the future, you know, all of these questions are actually logical. They are not that complicated. They've got pros and cons, etc. And I think we must undertake public policy in such a way that, ordinary citizens can look at the pros and cons and say this is right, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. And we should not be unreligious and I don't think this posture of defensiveness helps us to deepen the democracy that so many people fought for and died for. So it's important that we just, this is an issue of research, it may include GPR scientists, etc. But the ordinary people can understand this. And I think it is important for us to put them as simple as we can and talk to the debate and not be too defensive. And give leadership. Because I think part of what we expect from on this question is to give leadership. To say, this is our view. There may be. And yes, there are processes in cabinet, etc. But also there's a societal process as well, which all of us, the citizens of the country, need to be involved in. And I hope that going forward, we will not see much of this defensiveness on this issue. It may not be emotive at all. So with that, I think I don't want to overstate this point, Chairman, forgive me. Let's move on. You can come back on it later. I think Mr. Foley will still be here, at least upon hearing one of us. He said, with my permission, he can be that one. I think giving me that power over you, I might regret it. I may not agree with that relief after one. Okay, then the Sustainable Energy Africa. I think Ms. Leila Mohammed. Over to you, madam.
Thank you. Good morning, honourable members, honourable chair, Peter. Thank you for this opportunity that you created for public debate. We do welcome it. My presentation is, if not nuclear, then what? Hopefully today you'll hear a lot about what the problems are with nuclear. I'm going to try and present to you the options of, if you don't go nuclear, what the options are. My name is Leila Mohammed. I'm the director of a non-profit organization called Sustainable Energy Africa. We've been around since 2000, and we work with communities, with local government, provincial government, to promote sustainable energy approaches and practices in the development of South Africa. There is copies available. And our staff include engineers and economists, energy policy graduates. You have it out there. Yes, the copies of the presentation. Okay. So the outline of this presentation, I want to try and remind you about the challenges facing South Africans today, to try and have this debate within the understanding of those challenges. Also define what sort of energy system we want for South Africa, and then see whether nuclear fits that bill or whether there are other ways of meeting our energy needs. And then I'd like to end with a call to members of what we'd like thing to take away. So as a reminder, and you know this, but as I said, I want to just contextualize the nuclear debate within the challenges that people are facing. There's poverty, there's lack of jobs, there's increasing inequity, there's increases in the prices of basic goods and services, and we see this in the electricity sector with 18% expected high electricity tariffs. And we know that there's poor health and safety and security issues are also at the top of the mind of South Africans. So keeping that in mind, what sort of energy system do we want? We obviously want energy security, so that's homegrown energy options. We want an efficient, so that's energy as well as financial efficient system that is reliable. That means it's consistent. We want an energy system that does not harm our health and our grandchildren's health. And the Honourable Member McQueen mentioned that because we have to have a planet that can survive into the future. We want to survive. And we also want an energy system that creates jobs and the appropriate sorts of jobs. We want a system that meets the needs of people and not just industry. And we want a system that is cost effective and into the future. So not only looking at upfront costs, but into the future operational costs. So does nuclear energy fit this bill? And I know some of the presenters today will go into much more detail. Maybe in the short term, energy security, it does meet that, but not the long term, and I'll explain why later. It doesn't fit the bill because you'll hear today that there are safety risks and significant consequences to those risks. It's not necessary an efficient, financially efficient system. There's no investors, for example, the PBMR, and there's very little financing mechanism. If we go the specialized water reactor route, it will be government who will be paying for that system, not the private sector, and so it shows again that there are no independent investors. There's also environmental pollution and waste and health risks. And also you'll see later that going this route, we will not be increasing our jobs. We won't be creating more jobs. There might be a few specialized skills that will be developed, but in terms of addressing the jobs issue, going nuclear won't help that. Then what? So what fits those that description of the energy system that we would like in South Africa? And here I'd like to describe to you a sustainable energy approach. And we feel that that is the appropriate alternative in South Africa, considering the developmental state that we are in. So what is sustainable energy? It's reducing demand, it's generating some renewables, and then it's maximizing delivery, efficiency, and storage. Energy sources in South Africa, we have fossil fuels like coal, we have nuclear that is based on uranium, and both of those have finite sources. While we have also in South Africa a multitude of renewable energy options. If we look at nuclear energy, a recent German study released last year said that there's 41 years of uranium left in the world. So that's a finite source. After 41 years, give or take 10 years, we will be running out. The same for the fossil fuels. 50 years for oil, 200 years for coal, and 50 years for gas. If you look at renewables, the supply is infinite. It's available every day, and in South Africa, we very generously blessed with renewable energy potential. In South Africa, these are the options that are open to us. We have wind, solar, biomass, small-scale hydro, wave, ocean currents, etc. Wind, very well. There's very good potential around the coast. We're very well placed in South Africa with a large coastline to have wind generation. Same with solar, we have one of the highest solar radiation, and very good options here. Biomass, we've already taken advantage of for gas, but there are other sources as well. Micro hydro, not so small, not that large, but a welcome addition to the mix. There's also great potential for ocean energy, and again with our coastline, especially around the Western Cape, huge potential here. And then waste, there are small options in cities around landfill gas and sewage methane recovery. If we look at the international reviews of technical potential around renewable energy, we'll see that Africa produces the greatest. And that is largely due to the solar potential. And in Southern Africa, we are situated, we have one of those greatest potentials. The current use of explosive renewable energy is about 62.4 exajoules, see if we explore the renewable energy, we'll be able to meet that easily. In the international scenario, again, you will see that the International Energy Agency, in their scenarios for 2100 or 2050 plus, nuclear energy is on the downscale. They are predicting an increase in renewables and an increase in saving some energy efficiency to meet the demand as business as usual scenario. And the same goes for South Africa. This was a research that was completed last year, mid-June last year, which shows the renewable energy potential for South Africa, and it's the same thing. So we've been told by DME and others that the 2050 energy need is about 367 terawatt hours. By the studies done, we can also see that renewable energy can provide 267 terawatt hours. That's commercially exploitable if we just move the way we are investing our energy infrastructure money. You've probably seen this before, that Eskom is going to spend about 53 billion rand on generation over the next 5 years. If we just take 10% of that, so about 5 billion of Eskom's current allocation, we can kickstart this energy, sustainable energy market that can meet a significant proportion of our needs. And this has been echoed by the Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Partnership, an international body that says that the less developing countries must do this if they want to survive into the future. We also know that costs of technologies are decreasing. Here you see the cost of wind energy coming down tremendously, making it very affordable, as well as the price of PV, that photovoltaic, the solar panels that you can put on the roof. The price is also coming down. And internationally, the growth of the wind and the PV market is increasing tremendously. So we are falling behind if we're not getting into this market now. We also know that there are the finances that doesn't then need to come from government or Eskom through the climate change mechanism. We can get offsets to those sort of equivalents. And then another big thing, if we look at employment change in the electricity, the coal generated electricity sector, we'll see that even though consumption is increasing tremendously, jobs have fallen to a great extent. Jobs at Eskom and jobs in electricity related mining sector. If we look at the employment potential in renewable energy, we'll see that solar water heaters, for example, has huge potential compared to nuclear. So we should consider these employment options in the context of the South African challenges that we face. So even if we supply our energy through high-tech sources like the PBMR and nuclear energy, we'll still have to deal with energy poverty. And the best way to deal, so supply more electricity doesn't necessarily address the issues that people on these sources are facing. They're still going to, it's still going to be sometimes more expensive for them to use that electricity, and we still have cut-offs today, even though we have one of the cheapest electricity prices. So that is why we need to look at decentralized energy supply and appropriate energy services for people. And this means that we need to look at energy saving and energy demand management. For example, we saved about 400 megawatts in the Western Cape last year during the energy crisis. And that is at a fraction of the cost of building a new power station. It's worth a 1 megawatt to save energy while you need about 10 million to generate it. So the best way to address energy poverty is through energy efficiency and renewable energy. For example, there's a graph on the diagram on the right-hand side. Most of the energy used in your house is for water heating. If we put in solar water heaters in houses, not only will it be an energy poverty intervention, we'll also address our energy supply issue. And in that way, we don't have to basically go down this route of building new power, especially nuclear power stations. This graphic here shows you all the interventions that could be made at the household level to improve energy access, energy services, and I would encourage you to consider this as part of the bundle of options as an alternative to building new power stations. So the benefits of renewable energy and energy efficiency. In South Africa, we have significant resource availability. A number of those technologies, except for maybe the wind and ocean power, is mature and tested internationally. We have expertise internationally also to help us. We also have financing options available already. We have Latin investing in wind power outside of South Africa and not here. They're not investing in nuclear, which is good, but they're not investing in renewables either. We also will have a positive environmental legacy, so no waste as you find from a nuclear power station. And we also have increased employment of the appropriate skills base that exists in South Africa. So to remind ourselves of our sustainable development objective that GEEP has the mandate over, renewable energy and energy efficiency fits this sustainable development mandate clearly. If we look at the social issues in renewable energy, there are opportunities to facilitate gender equality. There are opportunities for socioeconomic development, job creation, poverty alleviation, as well as BEE investment opportunities and improved health for all. And this is if we look at different ways of generating energy services at the household level. Environmentally, obviously, there are reduced greenhouse gas emissions, a reduced environmental pollution, and also energy security through supply, diversity of supply. Economically, I mentioned this earlier, there's job creation, community and industrial economic development, it will offset energy imports and contribute to new generation capacity. So my message to the honourable members today is that if we go down this nuclear energy path, we will be getting ourselves into a route that takes us away from alternatives. Alternatives that put power in the hands of people, create appropriate skill-level jobs, doesn't harm the environment, and is based on a diversity of fuels that does not run out. And this alternative is the basket of renewable energy and energy efficiency options. Finally, my request is also to ask if we could possibly have more debates like this. It is a complex issue, and maybe one day is not enough. And if we have a participatory approach, similar to the asbestos summits that they've had, maybe that would also help. Also to request to the parliamentarians to push for the finalization of the national framework on sustainable development, because if we have that framework, it clearly rules out the nuclear option. And also to finalize the integrated energy plan for South Africa. It was put on hold this year at the time of the crisis, which is, I can't understand the reasoning behind that. And that plan should plan efficiently around the different options that is available in South Africa. And the best way to do that is also to have good and meaningful public participation to do that. We'd also like you to vote for more departmental funds to be allocated to renewable energy and energy efficiency. If you look at the headlines today, all those billions going to nuclear energy, if it can be rerouted to renewable energy and energy efficiency, we will really be on a better path. And then also, we're hoping that the information relayed here today gets included in the appropriate processes so that we're not left with the legacy of nuclear energy. And this last slide just shows that if we go down that nuclear path, the legacy is about 7 million years of uranium. So off that chart, we're going to be dealing with uranium into the future. And 250,000 years has this life of plutonium that we're going to be dealing with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Madam, for the quite an interesting. We have a good mobile to engage with you.
mantra like already.
Thank you, sir. I think you made with the previous presentation, you made a very important point of note. You see, here at Parliament, we really want a constructive debate around these issues, especially sources of energy, there are many reasons in the world, including climate change. Now, we have therefore to look into these options in a very constructive way, not in a partisan way. I just want to give you a very good example of what you've just said. You have said that nuclear fuel source is finite. You have shown your slide from that they say it's going to be how many years? 41 years. But you see, I think you have to be objective. If you are talking about a nuclear fuel source, that is uranium. But you see, that is not the only source of nuclear fuel generation. Because fusion power is not based on uranium. You see, fusion power is totally different. And it is infinite, just like renewable energy. Because it's based on renewable sources. So, then your argument then starts to fall away in terms of nuclear, you see. So it must be sustainable, even the argument, that you are talking about finite renewable sources. Now, a certain people like myself would say, oh, then it means if I come with nuclear fusion power, nuclear option, then I'm fine. I don't know whether if that's what you are saying. But be it as it may, I just want to continue also to make some comments. You said something about ocean energy source. The ocean energy source is based on what you call seawater type generation of energy, based on seawater type generation. And that is a source that has been explored. Unfortunately, it is not able to be used at industrial scale level. And if it were to be used at industrial scale level, it would be very expensive to generate that energy. Those are the things that have already been made as standard. So, that is why I said we have to know what we are talking about when we talk about these things. My committee, I'm from Science and Technology. My committee recently is from Sweden. And we raised questions around all these issues, actually, because I also have interest in nuclear energy. Way of generating whether it is safe or not. So I wanted to bring some issues surrounding the new development of nuclear power in the wasting repository. And so we met with the top of Sweden scientists there, and we raised questions including fuel cell technology, why hydrogen economy, how far are they? And actually, to our very interesting experience, they said here in around, if you go outside this town, we already had gone as far as constructing some buses using fuel cell technology, which is renewable and which is very clean. But they say the project proved to be very expensive. We abandoned them. There are only three running on the street. And in fact, when we came out of that meeting, there was one which was fueling hydrogen on the road, opened the booth because it fueled a different way. It was very interesting as an experiment. So these other options, as you see, they are not being used. Sometimes that they are very expensive for now. The technologies are not developed to make them inexpensive. I was in England, I came on an environmental conference, this climate change conference, last 2005. And these methods also were discussed. Actually, one of the top researchers of Mobil, oil company, said that indeed we can argue about climate change, but the problem of saying that the fossil fuels are going to go away now, we don't think that is true. First of all, countries that are basically, their economies are dependent on fossil fuels. I'm not going to abandon fossil fuels now, especially the developing countries that use their energy from fuel source, like South Africa itself. And they said that, so they actually, what the world is supposed to do is to look into the mixture of weather. we want to use fossil fuels in a greener way than they are used now, and this is the ongoing research, and so forth. So I'm trying to say that we have to look into a real constructive debate when we look into this issue. The problem of PBMR, it may be a good, probably, research project, but it should be, it must be presented as such, that it's a research project. It's not going to really save energy problems for South Africa. Probably, if you put it like that, it sounds the other way. Because indeed, we have got the community here, we've visited them, in fact, they are great to us. Now, other people have exaggerated that it's going to save energy problem. It is an ongoing research program which is going to probably produce some of the best, safer energy sources based on clean energy nuclear, but it's a long way forward. That's what they told us when we visited them recently. So I'm trying to just give a constructive debate around this.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chair, the presenter in his presentation mentioned that mentioned an energy system that does not harm people's health. Now, Chair, what I'd like to say is that I think denying our people electricity in the past was just a way to humiliate our people. It was not only done in rural areas where we need electricity today, because in rural areas we know the government has done a lot, but the rural areas are deep and we still need more electricity, more power, more energy in rural areas. It was also done in cities, Chairperson. I would like to mention the incident of the power station in Orlando. The power station in Orlando, Chairperson, used to take power to rich people only in the big city. But we in Soweto, we did not get any energy from that power station. All we got was pollution. In the morning, there was smoke going to Soweto. In the afternoon, there was more smoke going to Soweto. Our babies were inhaling that smoke. We were inhaling that smoke. And which I don't think it was, although the authorities never, some of the authorities are here. During that time, Chairperson, the authorities never admitted that that those power stations are harmful to our health. But what happened is, in Soweto schools, they started the mobile clinic that they were going to examine children for TBL X-ray. They were X-raying our children. And sometimes elderly people will be called also to be X-rayed. Why were people X-rayed when there was no harm done by that, the police? And Chairperson, like once more, after that X-ray that came in from time to time, in Soweto, there's this hospital called Santa, the TB hospital in Soweto. It is in near Baragwanath. Why was that hospital set there in Soweto? Why not in Santo? Why not in Horton? Why particularly in Soweto? And why all those X-ray, mobile X-rays to schools? It means they knew that those fumes were harmful to our health. So all we need, Chairperson, is that energy that
is not harmful to the health of the people. And energy that we can, the people can afford. Now, Jefferson, something else comes up, always comes up, when the question of this new energy comes in. The question of money. Why should, whenever there's something that is going to help the poor, especially the previously disadvantaged people, the question of money always comes in. As if we are not paying taxpayers, because we are also taxpayers and we need that that tax we pay to work for us and for our people. Chairperson, there's been a mention of solar, and that as I have said in the past, and I'm saying it again, is a failure, because it can be used for a few things, that and that, but not for everything in the house. And here in our country, where in South Africa do we have sunshine 12 months in every year? There is none. We come to a cold there's a time when it becomes cold and there's no sun. Now where can we get that energy from? They tell us about batteries, but that thing has failed. It has really failed, Jefferson. And that energy can suit our people in rural areas. We need a clean energy in our rural areas, as well as people in cities. And Chairperson, can we be assured that coal generating powers are safe? I don't think so. Then people are sick. In Newcastle, people are sick. Those who work with coal generating power stations. Why should we be denied energy now? Because we need it. We need energy in our whether it's rural areas or in towns. We know today in towns everybody, even a shack they've got in a shack there's electricity. But why do we forget the people in rural areas? Because they need electricity as much as we need it here in town. And today rural areas is not only about people who are doing farming. It is about everybody. We are moving from urban areas to rural areas where you can have a quiet life. And people need electricity there. Chairperson, I don't know, perhaps I'll come in again, but I would like this use of energy to be closely examined, so that we should be sure that, about this energy. We speak about nuclear today, and we've got plenty of nuclear in our country. Why can't we use it peacefully, so that our people can enjoy the use of clean electricity? Chairperson, I thank you.
No, Mr. Blanche was saying that I should intervene and restrict people from speaking. I think that overall people have been... okay, let him assist. Please come close to the microphone.
Mr. Chairman, we're here to hear views from outside.
That's why we've got a joint committee to listen to what other people are coming to tell us. If we therefore have a question, I would ask you to get the question asked so that the question can be answered. It's great to be here to make speeches. We're in the wrong chamber. The speeches we can make in the house. And that's what we should be doing now.
Chairperson, we've got presenters here. If we don't tell these presenters what is happening in our areas, in rural areas, in cities, then how will they know what is happening? We have to tell them. We've got to talk to the chairperson. We are not going to be restricted by one person to tell us that we cannot speak here, we can go and speak anywhere. If it's for people that you think you can come to, have come here to say things, they have time, they've got time to say those things. You must not come and cut me. Who is he after all? Thank you.
Okay, no.
I think a public hearing is not about questions and answers. It's about sharing so that people agree on a certain essential point or issues. So there may be a situation like I was currently. He may make an input where the input probably has got a little bit of duality, which needs to be first put in the correct context, that we can then deal with it when put in the proper context. So I think members have to be allowed to make an input wherever they feel that the input was inadequate, and it's not about the questions and answers only. But of course, the essence must be that the presenters must present, and we should intervene when we feel that we do not understand the issue they are presenting. Thank you very much.
I think both the responses to Honorable Banch are adequate. I'm pretty comfortable with the Banch. I've said, no, don't come with that end. That will be useful. We will go through the business of the day, hopefully of that. I think also people are here, actual stakeholders in the fraternity. They wouldn't have come to Parliament if they're not interested to be here. So we must be patient with each other. All of us want to talk about this. This is an important issue. I take your point, but for now, I'm also very concerned with that. People who work with me know that. Don't worry about it, Mr. Bancho. Your concerns are noted. I thought I had my Honorable Wang, and then Gareth, and then Mr. Fagan. That order, and then I'll say something, and then we'll try to move faster after this round. Over to you, Mr. Wang.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, sorry for my apologies for being late. The Further Committee on Public Enterprise was having a closed meeting with Travis Ava. So I'm on the fact-finding mission with mainly two questions to the presenter today. First one was, on her slide of decreasing cost of wind energy, I'm interested to find out at what scale, as you're looking at, you say the price has come down to affordable. I mean, what do you mean by affordable? You can tell me, a road road cost $2 million and now costs $1 million. You know, it's come down considerably, but still unaffordable to every term commercial application. And related to that, especially on our wind project in around the globe, especially in Western Cape, the one recent, I think 2 years ago, sponsored by Danida, the Danish government. So I like to find, because from the research I've done, I've heard these wind energy at the moment is not commercially viable, where you normally need government support or government commitment in terms of tax incentive or rebates to make it happen, because the cost of establishing these wind farms is so high. So I'd just like to be on that. And then the second question is, on your previous, I think, first or sixth slide, on your statement on PBMRs has no financing mechanism and no investors, I think it might be a little bit misleading. Perhaps you can elaborate more on that, because myself, I'm leading the debate within the ANC study group on other enterprise, particularly on the energy sector, which is PBMR and ESCOM. So as far as we had input from the ministry and the stakeholders, they are investors from overseas, especially from the US Westinghouse, and then they are also financing mechanisms in terms of future buyers from other African countries and possibly the Chinese agreement as well. So perhaps you can elaborate more on that. From what sources you obtain or suggesting that there's no financing mechanism. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, if you say...
Honourable one, can you put off your microphone?
Thank you, Chairperson. First, let me say it's good to be back on this committee. I don't know if you officially know, but today is my first day back. So, after a year away, it's good to be back on the committee that I most want to be on. First, thank you to the presenter. A few comments and then a few questions. Yes, I certainly agree with the role of energy efficiency. I think the International Energy Agency says that by 2050 we can save approximately half of the electricity we generate today just using energy efficiency measures. And it is certainly the cheapest. I've heard it with energy efficiency referred to as, I think, the fourth or fifth type of electricity generation, in fact, because of its immense savings. And yes, indeed, we need to do a lot more in South Africa. And perhaps there should be a sense of urgency around energy efficiency. I often feel that renewables get an unnecessarily hard time in South Africa because the argument is always that they're very expensive. And of course, the technology curves for renewables remain steep, but so does nuclear at one stage. And nuclear benefited worldwide from billions of dollars of subsidies. Now, presumably, if we were to give renewables similar support, we could bring down those costs. But my specific questions are, if we are to embark on a nuclear build program, the lead time is still going to be very, very considerable. We're really only looking beyond 10 years from now to see the benefits of generation from nuclear. We do have a need for increased generation. That's clear. We have a growing economy, and we're all very proud of that. What is the time frame for renewables in South Africa? And again, I'm just talking generally, a mixture of renewables and so on. And granted, that may link to my previous points about costs, I accept that. So if you could expand on that as well. Secondly, another problem that many people have with renewables, well, they say it's expensive, but then, of course, we don't factor into the full cost of electricity in South Africa, which are the environmental externalities, which we have heard about pollution and so on as well. It's inevitable that electricity prices will increase in South Africa to fund the new capital builds as well, which may in fact serve to benefit renewables as well. And the last, I didn't see it in your presentation, and perhaps you are not engaged with it because it relates more to fossil fuels. But granted that carbon does, fossil fuels do form, well, I don't want to make it inevitable, but I mean it's exceptionally likely that they're going to form a large portion for the foreseeable future of our base load generation. And here I'm talking specifically about coal. What are your views on carbon capture and storage? Is it something that the government in South Africa should be looking at? Because if we are going to build more coal power stations, particularly, we need to obviously make that coal as clean as possible. So those are, Chair, that's fine for the moment. Thank you.
Honourable Freeland.
Thank you, Chair. I've also been absent from this committee for a while, and it's good to be back. Particularly for this issue, and I'll try and avoid making a speech, but I have to respond to some of the comments being made, and also have to put some questions through. I mean, I agree with my honourable colleague here as well. I think it's very difficult to debate renewable energy versus nuclear energy, given the unfair playing field that renewable energy has had over the last 40 years. I almost feel that, you come in from a technology which hasn't had the subsidies, it hasn't had the time, it hasn't had the support given to it, which nuclear specifically has. And I think what would be useful is to actually see the levels of subsidies around the world that have been given to nuclear. We've heard today, for instance, McLean Corbell saying that the CBMR is probably just a research project. Well, it's a research project that costs us over 2.5 billion rand. What could you have done with that 2.5 billion rand in renewable energy? We need to ask that question. And so I find it very strange saying that, oh, we've got to subsidize wind. Well, we certainly haven't subsidized wind to any extent with regards to nuclear and the way that we subsidize that. But I think what is also important is that when we talk about renewable in South Africa, we always tend to look at it from present-day situation. And we look at the world energy in terms of present-day energy. And without a doubt, present-day energy is dominated by coal, nuclear, large hydro. That is the present-day energy system. What is also very clear to me, though, is that we are moving in a very different direction globally. And what I think is important, and what I would like to see as well, is how do we build a renewable energy industry in South Africa, which, yes, is going to require support from government now, is going to require subsidies, but could in the long term position us as world leaders in this field? And what are the potentials for renewable energy worldwide for us to then go into that market and actually to be world leaders in that? Because also what I'm seeing in terms of our nuclear build now, moving away from the PBMR, moving to conventional nuclear reactors, how much of that is going to be imported machinery? How much are we going to import into this country to build those nuclear reactors? And how much from renewable, if we get that industry going now, to what extent can we source and actually build all of our own renewable energy in this country and in fact export it around the world? That is the kind of far-thinking type of stuff that we need to look at, because if we build a nuclear reactor today, it's going to be locked in for 50 years, the same with the coal-fired power station, and we need to look not today, not 10 years, but 40 years ahead and say, what is our future energy direction? Thank you, Chair.
is a toy that we now are recently fascinated with now. Other people have not seen it before. We must be pragmatic. Other people have tried it, it's heard here and there, but we think we can improve it. But it's an experiment. The public must know that it's an experiment, so I think the will come off. The public must say, hey, what happened in experiment? And we all know about the supersonic Concorde, this wonderful aeroplane, etc. And where France and British been putting billions and billions of people putting the thing together, and now we all know where the Concorde is, it's in some scrapyard somewhere. Now, that's what we must be aware of, that if we put all these billions in the PBMR, it might be consigned to scrap heap one day. And the public must be, this is the whole idea why the chairperson is brought together here, is that the public must be aware of all the various modalities and options. So now, they should say, this parliament was quiet when this was happening, and they never even gave the stakeholders a chance to talk. Right, that's point one. Point two, I'm a lay person here, but I think it's not a question of either or. Why don't we have an integrated approach, right? I know one cannot be a store electricity. You can't keep it in a bag and say, I'll switch on when I want it. But if you don't use it, it goes. But it's not possible to have a kind of an integrated a metric. In other words, during the day when the sun is hot, you temporarily store that energy, you augment it, put it somewhere in the grid, and in the evening when it is cold, then you resort then to chemical energy, which is electricity, so that now the wind energy, the ionic energy is given a chance during the day, and the solar energy, and at night, when you know that it's not there, then the other energy sources will kick in, so that we've got an integrated energy system, as opposed to either or.
Dr. Ngobo, this is a day-long thing. If you need it now, you'll have no hurry. We will come there to you. Just some few comments. I think to build what Honorable Kim, I would like to know whether are you not should we completely reject nuclear energy as an option within the context of an energy mix? Is that what you're telling us? Or can it be considered as one of the, not the principal one, but one of the elements in a comprehensive energy mix that we also include renewables, not as we're bringing them up in a bigger way, cleaning our code, etc. So that's the one point I'd like to raise. Secondly, there's the issue of reliability. The challenge with renewables, I think, has to do with the fact that it depends on the sun, depends on the wind. These things no one controls completely. You can't control the sun, maybe dark, cloudy, etc. Again, the wind as well. Now, should we not consider, again, having an energy mix that appreciates the lack of reliability of both the sun and the wind, so that you factor all these dimensions? Thirdly, is the issue of saving energy. Can you speak more on this? What would be an energy saving package for South Africa? What are the elements of it? To what extent would that facilitate or impede the 6-8% growth that we want if we were to put this economy at a global level and make it competitive? And then, I think the point of carbon sequestration has been raised. Comment on that as well. It's a beautiful on carbon sequestration for claiming growth here. Those questions, if you could be a little bit fast, cooperate with us about here. Don't sacrifice in quality.
In the future, I'm going to also ask my colleague Liz McDay to answer the first question and a few of the others on fusion. She's part of our team, I mean, the teamwork at our organization. So she's going to answer quickly and then I'll respond to this.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chair. I want to maybe help you in terms of time is to say that I don't think one can address all the issues of renewable energy in this kind of UK energy hearing. And my first suggestion would be that the portfolio committee takes time to have a specific hearing which raises the issues of renewable energy, the substance issue, and the challenges that renewable energy faces. Because I don't think one can do justice to it today. But I just wanted to speak to a couple of points. I know Leila asked me to speak to the first question, but I can no longer remember what that was. But the issue around the fusion, yeah. The issue of the nuclear fusion, I think the critical thing around nuclear energy is fission energy results in this high level waste. And the problem is that over the years since 1950 or 1940, since people have been working on nuclear fusion, they haven't got it right. So the thing is, do we put our money in the same way as the PBMR has been going since 1993, do we put our money into something that people have been trying for a number of years, or do we put our money into technologies which are mature, working technologies all over the world, and that way we meet our energy needs? And maybe in 50 years' time, we re-look at those kinds of research projects. That would be my answer on the fusion one. But I just wanted, I had a specific answer to some of the questions about pricing. I just completed a review of renewable energy, some of the technologies available and some of the challenges and how we might address them. And maybe just to say that based on the information that I obtained, if we looked at solar thermal electricity, which does exactly what Comrade Aubrey was talking about, where you can generate large-scale renewable energy for industrial use, and it's reliable, and you can store when the sun doesn't shine and put it out. The predictions were that the startup costs for such a plant are about 40 cents a kilowatt hour. And by 2012, the scenario is that this will be lower than new baseload fossil fuel. So that's not very far into the future. So, and again with wind, the cost are put forward as 27 to 70 cents kilowatt hour at the moment and predicted to decline by 40 to 50% over the next 20 years. So just some indications that, you know, I think, as I say, I don't want to take up a lot of time, but renewable energy is something that is not something into the future, something we should invest in now to reach the gains in 10 years' time rather than the nuclear.
Can I just make one point of correction? Just to honor what I said. Just 1 minute. What was her name? Liz McVeigh. Is saying that, well, I just want to correct that because practically we must be informed about this because I happen to be a real person on the side. Nuclear fusion actually has now been finalized. I have gone to the project in Oxford, the what they call the JET project. In fact, by 1995 they had finished the project. And they had said that by 2003 the first prototype would be put in place. Actually, in 2 years ago, we had a joint international workshop, Minister of Science and Technology and Minister of Education. And scientists came from there. It has now been, they were now looking for the place where to locate the first prototype fusion reactor. It has now, Japan and Russia were competing that time in 95. But now it is, the first one is going to be in Switzerland. It is now that it's complete. I've seen the plant is working. So, we're not talking about something now in the sky. It's here.
Sorry, I do apologize. Sorry, maybe I misled the committee. What I meant is like commercially viable projects, mass-scale rollout. To me, fusion technology is still research. It's a project that will carry on and gradually, maybe over 50 years, it might become the way to go. But for me, mature renewable energy technology is what we should put our money into now for the reasons that have been highlighted.
I'm not against renewables, by the way. I was just giving the that we must bring something that if it is about renewable fusion, it's renewable. So let us talk about nuclear in terms of renewable or unrenewable. If we say fusion as a research project, it's already there, it's been finished. It's going to be the first experimental power reactor in Switzerland. And we're going to see how much years. So we can now talk about 50 years. Because many people who have been arguing about CDMR have been saying, fusion is about something else. 50 more is going to be now. It was 2000 when they say PNR will be in place in 2001, and it's not in place until today.
Thank you. Both of you.
Okay. On the question of ocean power, there is a commercial plant already in Scotland. It's the one with the red snake. It's already commercially viable and in operation, so it's not a developmental project. In South Africa, there is a company called Ocean Power that has already started negotiating space off our south southwest coast for not only research, but for a demonstration project. So it is a technology that is fast coming onto onto line. Your other question was answered on fusion. On the fossil fuel base, I think we go into the future still have to rely on coal, and South Africa has huge coal deposits. We're going to need to clean up our coal, so carbon storage is important, but we mustn't let that distract us from developing the alternatives like sustainable energy. And I think the members down the road in the middle have very good examples of the costs and the subsidies that have gone into nuclear and coal, and how if we just shift a little bit of that investment into renewables, we'd be making a difference. For example, if we just look at nuclear power and the need to insure it, how much money does that cost? So those sort of costs we're not taking into consideration. We're not taking into consideration the externalities that the honourable member also mentioned about the respiratory health issues. So these are not legacy issues that come from renewable energy. So we have to consider all of that. On the issue of scale and affordability, I think some of the members have answered your question, Member Wang, about the fact that subsidies are being put into coal and fossil fuel. We also see that it's becoming very affordable in India, so and their market's been affordable for years. In South Africa, it would come under the new fossil fuel electricity tariff. So you could, if the scale is right, at about greater than 50 megawatts, so 50 megawatts is small. So if you're going up to 200 megawatts, it could become very affordable at less than 40 cents per kilowatt hour, but we need to speed up the development process. Many developers are being stuck in EIAs, yes, but EIAs that don't follow the proper route, or stuck in areas where it could be speeded up and they could be supported to develop these projects in a quicker time frame. And then the prices do come down. Mm. And then I think there was another question on the time frame. In PE, they're setting up a wind farm in Jeffreys Bay, and that turnaround time is 3 years. So it's going to be much quicker, if the EIA goes well, it's going to be much quicker than putting up a nuclear plant. So it would be, in our short term, easier to meet our energy needs if we focus on renewables than building huge six-packs or nuclear plants. When it comes to renewables, your storage is very important. And there are some options already. Small scale is pump storage and desalination plants. But into the future, we would need to look at this. And this lends us back to the rural areas where you don't have to have a solar home system that has given people problems in the past. You could have a mini-grid system where there is a storage facility and it works on the very same basis that you would have in a city. So renewable energy could be set up in a way that doesn't impact on people's lives and reduces their quality of life as we've seen with a solar home system. So your question about should nuclear be part of the mix, I think that it makes sense to see Kubrick to the end of its life, but not to build new nuclear plants. So in Germany they did something similar, where they phased out nuclear energy and brought in renewable energy to fill the gap and to expand in terms of displacing coal generation. So I think that is a route that we could look at. But I would echo the need perhaps to have another full-day workshop or summit on renewable energy with the honourable members, because there are some issues that needs to be discussed and debated like this one. Then on the issue of reliability, there's a new term that's called the portfolio planning approach to renewable energy. So that approach says that we need to build systems that complement each other. So not only have a wind generation plant, but have a wind, wave and solar plant, so that when the wind's not blowing, the sun will be shining. Nature works like that. So it will be a system that supports and increases the reliability of renewable energy. And couple that with appropriate storage facilities, it can work. But most importantly, if we're going to go the renewable energy route, we would need to become more energy efficient. And I don't believe that it's going to decrease our growth rate. There are business industry in South Africa has become very complacent over the years because energy has been so cheap. There are simple things that they can do, like variable speed drives and machinery that they can easily initiate now and save energy. I think if we go the route of renewable energy, there are options for meeting that 6% target that comes from building the components of renewable energy. And then the last word on energy saving, what that plan could be. There is a plan that national government, through the Energy Efficiency Agency, has put together, but we're not, and it's part of the integrated energy plan, the initial integrated energy plan, but we're not implementing it. So that's, there are options. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mohammed, for a very fruitful dialogue. Could we move on then to Ms. Marie Lefering? If you could come over. I believe Ms. Lisa Rink, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is here on her own capacity as a citizen. So over to you, Citizen Lisa Rink.
I wish to see if I may have it correctly. I am also a member of EarthLove, and I also act in cooperation with Greencross, the Chronicle Group, Groundwork, and other NGOs. I wish, first of all, Mr. Chairperson, to thank you for the opportunity to also contribute to this forum. I wish to initially state that my submissions are done in diffidence and deference, that is with respect and also with modesty, but it is not done with timidity, because I do feel that uranium contamination and its hazards or risks can be perceived as neither trivial nor insignificant or frivolous, but of appreciable magnitude. As my esteemed examiner's audience may reflect, uranium has two properties. It's radioactive and has radiological or carcinogenic health risks. It is also chemically toxic and therefore has chemical toxicity risks. Uranium furthermore has a half-life of, in terms of 1 × 10^8 to 10^10 years, or concisely or simply stated, 713 million years. So the risks or hazards can be foreseen to be long-term. Prefatory or preliminary to my submission, I wish to be permitted to briefly allude to the law of evidence. In terms of the law of evidence, it is admissible in a court of law to adduce evidence of character or of reputation. For example, if a person has been charged with an offence, it can be suggested that the crime is unlikely or likely as a result of a good character or reputation or bad character or reputation. It is for this reason and for the analogous reasoning that I wish to refer to the historic precedent that has been established with regards to the institutional control, the management and the monitoring of hazardous waste, particularly uranium, as well as the enforcement, the capacity, the willingness and the commitment to enforce environmental legislation. I am now referring to the historical precedent that has been established in the Wonderfontein Strait area. The Wonderfontein Strait area has significant contaminated areas due to gold mining activities, historic and current gold mining areas. The Wonderfontein Strait area stretches from the Westrand towards Potchefstroom or the Northwest province. And in terms of the official scientific report, inter alia, the Water Research Commission Report 1095 of 2002, the Wetlands Report of the Council of Geoscience, and the Water Research Commission Report 1240 of 2006, it is entitled An Assessment of Sources, Pathways, Mechanisms, and Risks of Current and Potential Future Pollution of Water and Sediment in Gold Mining Areas of the Wonderfontein Strait Catchment. We were credibly informed by the learned authors that after many sites that were sampled, a significant number of sites had elevated levels of uranium which exceeded the legislative regulatory limits or exclusion limits for regulation. The National Nuclear Regulator was therefore called upon to make a regulatory decision concerning this. In order for us to conceive this accuracy, in other words, the elevated levels of uranium, in terms of the report, it stated that 16 milligrams per kilogram uranium equals an activity concentration of 0.2 becquerels per gram. After the publishing of this report, the National Nuclear Regulator then increased the regulatory limit to 0.5 becquerels per gram. The National Nuclear Regulator, in a response to make a regulatory decision concerning these radioactive sites, then published a disclaimer in the report. Just incidentally, I have an information fact for whoever needs it. They published a disclaimer disclaiming simply the radiological carcinogenic health risk assessment, because it was stated that it was based on the United States Environmental Protection Agency's methodology and not upon an international methodology. They then declared that they would conduct their own investigations and make the findings available to the public. As to date of this submission, the findings have not been made available to the public, which is a year and a half later. So in the absence of evidence to the contrary, we do feel, it's our modest opinion, that the evidence in terms of the radiological carcinogenic health risk question must stand or hold. The Water Research Commission found, in terms of this report, that the tailings dam, that is the crushed ore of the gold, has been removed by means of leaching with cyanide. That slurry contains, that is the tailings dam in the area I'm referring to, the Wonderfontein Strait area, 100,000 tons of uranium. Annually, the gold mines discharge 50 tons of uranium into the receiving water sources. From point discharges, 12 tons are discharged annually. charged annually through percolation or seepage from the tailings dam. The seepage water or the percolated water contains 1,000 to 1 million times the levels of uranium of the background uranium. It is significantly elevated in comparison to background uranium levels. So, furthermore, tailings have historically been discharged into sinkholes in order to stabilize the ground. When three mining flow patterns restore itself and mines close, then the tailings will become secondary sources of uranitarian contamination. As a result of the discharges of uranium from the gold mine industry over a period of 120 years, we are credibly informed that the sediments in the upper Bonderfontein Strait now contain 1,100 milligrams per kilogram uranium. In order for my esteemed audience to accurately conceive the elevated levels of this, the Klaas-Straal Dam, which is a dam that has never received effluent from mines or from discharges from mines, uranium level is 1 milligram per kilogram. The upper Bonderfontein Strait is 1,100 milligrams per kilogram. In the lower Bonderfontein Strait, I specifically refer to the Andries Kutsie Dam, contains 900 milligrams per kilogram uranium. We are informed by the learned authors that the uranium at present as other heavy metals such as cadmium, arsenic, copper, cobalt and zinc are presently absorbed in the sediment, the fluvial sediment of the Bonderfontein Strait. But under very plausible environmental conditions, these heavy metals can become remobilized or can be solubilized into the water column, which eventually will reach the Bosco Dam, which feeds the Kosciuszko to a municipality, and eventually the Vaal Dam. We are told that the plausible environmental conditions that can cause the remobilization or the solubilization of uranium are, for example, acid mine drainage, tailings spillages which regularly occur, acid rain, dredging operations, the drying out of the sediment, and then a sudden influx of water and something as mundane as the turbulence caused by cattle drinking from the water or sugar flowing in the water. I am now referring specifically to the acid mine drainage. You may all know, if you are aware of the history of the West Rand, that in the year 2002, an unexpected detail took place on the property of Harmony Gold, that is in the Krugersdorp Randfontein area. These volumes are increasing the detail volume. The deep tank water contains acidity that is of mining that has been done prior to 2002, has a pH balance of 2.2, that is the acidity of battery acid. It also has elevated levels of uranium and other heavy metals. As an emergency measure, this water was then discharged into the Robinson Lake. At the time of this discharge, the Robinson Lake was a viable fishing area as well as a recreation area. Since the waters have been discharged, the deep tank waters, and I wish to reiterate, the volumes are increasing as we speak. The waters in the Robinson Lake now has an acidity of 2.7 and a uranium contamination of 16 grams per liter. To again help you to accurately conceive the elevated levels of the uranium, the background uranium levels for fresh water is 0.0004 milligrams per liter. This is significantly elevated. What is therefore imperative is that strong institutional control should be exercised in order to prevent these environmental conditions to develop. Regrettably, there has been poor institutional control with the result that we are now faced with historic and apparent contamination of the Wonderfontein-Spruit area. There was a health risk assessment done, as I have alluded to previously. The health risk in terms of the carcinogenic or radiological health risk of the water and sediment in the Wonderfontein-Spruit is 2.22. The chemical toxicity health risk quotient is 6.67. Any number above 1 represents a serious health threat. I wish now to mention, and I think there I do concur with the lady over there, that in the apartheid years, the vulnerable and now the previously disadvantaged people, the black communities, were placed downstream and downwind. This has not changed. The population groups that are most affected by the health risks and the risk pertaining to uranium contamination are the subpopulation groups or residents of informal settlements such as Pakhriso, Kutsum, Bekersdal, Tukumfrit, and so forth. The residents in these informal settlements, they are especially vulnerable because their health had already been compromised because of a high percentage of HIV/AIDS as well as chronic and acute malnutrition. Therefore, we would have assumed that there would have been an awareness creation amongst the affected communities. We have repeatedly called upon the Honourable Minister of the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry, as well as the National Nuclear Regulator, to create awareness of these risks or hazards pertaining to the use of the water in the Wonderfontein Spruit. The residents in these informal settlements use the water for hygiene, for drinking, and for irrigation. They are especially vulnerable. What also I should not omit to mention is that the report informs us too that in certain rural communities, a pregnant black woman would eat the mud, or children would eat the mud. The mud, of course, in this area is highly contaminated with uranium, up to 1,100 milligrams per kilogram. This also presents a risk. We have furthermore called upon the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry, as well as the National Nuclear Regulator, to do an epidemiological study in order to quantify the health risks. Regrettably, it has not been done, as a pathway too for the contamination and health impact has not been determined. So we do feel that the risk averse or precautionary principle also apply in terms of the NEMA in this regard. What I have just enumerated to you are basically the historical institutional control, the management and the monitoring of uranium contamination. What we can conclude respectfully is that there has either been very poor institutional control or absent institutional control and very little environmental enforcement. In conclusion, I wish to briefly allude to the Act of Parliament that has have application to the matter under consideration. First of all, the National Environmental Management Act, number 107 of 1998, refers to precautionary or risk-averse principle. It also refers that environmental impact should not be unfairly distributed, and that especially should vulnerable and previously disadvantaged communities be taken into consideration. A principle that is especially prevalent in the National Environmental Management Act is the polluter must pay principle. It has a retrospective application. In other words, polluters must pay for historic, that is past pollution as well as current pollution. In terms of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, that is number 28 of 2002, it is subservient to the National Environmental Management Act, and in terms of this act, directors who pollute or contaminate or cause ecological degradation can be held personally or collectively responsible for pollution caused inside or outside mine properties that is caused advertently or inadvertently. It has a retrospective application too. In terms of the National Water Act, any person who has benefited for remediation can be recovered from them. If there are more than one polluter in a particular site, as in the case of the Wonderfontein site, because there are a number of gold mining companies, then in terms of the National Environmental Management Act and the National Water Act, there must be an apportionment of liability according to the extent of pollution. Most regrettably, we have heard the written reply from the Minister of the Department of Water Affairs. Recently, there were questions asked of her in Parliament, and this was her response. No steps are being taken to lay criminal charges against past polluters. We consider this to be unfair, inequitable, and unjust. That communities, local communities, and the general public, the ordinary taxpayers, must carry the cost for pollution that they have not caused and from which they have derived no benefit. The externalization of costs upon ordinary people in order to maximize the profits of gold mining companies are unjust, immoral, and unethical. And it is therefore that we draw on this analogy to say that if this is the institutional control that will be exercised with the proposed federal-based modular technology, if there is no enforcement of environmental legislation, if there is no monitoring or management, since we have the historical example, then we would be very prudent to reconsider this option. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What you presented is a very worrying submission. What I'll be interested to find out, I mean, you're talking about very high levels of radiation contamination. Have you seen the effects of that in terms of the health of these communities? I mean, have there been examples? And can you just talk about what some of those effects have been, or at least what you can kind of do?
Thank you, Chairperson. Madam, I'm really interested in your input. But I thank you for bringing in that input. My interest is in the Klerksdal Dam. You know, around that place, our people, there are a lot of diamond mines, and they wash their diamonds there. But now, with this, what you mentioned now about the contamination of those dams. Don't our people get water from that dam?
Exactly.
To drinking water, yes. And for their animals as well.
Yeah, it's a
sole
source of water for
informal people. That's what I know. And how should people get, made aware of what is going on there? Because we get the people get this water, and they are happy to get the water because there's no water there. Water is very scarce. But now there's no knowledge about the contamination. How are our people going to be made aware of? Is there a way of doing it? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, also to follow up, and I'm amazed at your absolute recall of all the facts that was mentioned. When you say in this submission, abundant anecdotal evidence exists of mental retardation, pancreatic cancers, have studies been done that underpin what your findings are? And I just wondered, I mean, Mr. Faree is here from Zeus, and I don't like to put him on the spot, but surely contamination of this sort should also be a cause of great concern to the Department of Environmental Affairs as well. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. My colleague here says he's amazed. I'm flummoxed. And the excellent brain of this lady here. Yeah, now, 2 points. number one. What is your background? What do you do in life? so that we can contextualize this very wonderful input. Because he speaks like a lecturer, he speaks like a lawyer, can make the message. And what is actually inspiring us, me as a public representative, is to see a member of the public responding to an advert to come and make an input that will help us as legislators to make laws that can defend democracy and make sure that people can transfer. And now juxtapose to the people who are not there, the ESCOMs of this world, the PDM, etc., who are supposed to be here. They've got the entire machinery, they come here and submit requests for money. When we ask them to come and account, they keep away. And you, unfinanced, get into a taxi or a bus or your own little country, actually come here and take the trouble. So, what do you do? What do you actually do? I'm fascinated.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I think I must also echo the voice of the last member. That's a very brilliant input, and that is what we want when people come here. At least they must do some homework and come with some scientific facts, not just come and partisan. And that's very dangerous. Here in Parliament, we're supposed to be neutral because we're public representatives. We both represent the institution of government and the public, so we mediate between the two bodies. Therefore, it is very important where we feel that the members of the public are making a very reasonable and constructive input to take it up, and where they are making unreasonable input and again to challenge that. For instance, I just want to comment on one of these questions. I'm seizing this opportunity. They have said here, some of the members of the public, that the government has no strategy for renewable energy. It's not true. We have, it's new, maybe they have not yet been informed, but we have a very intensive strategy that has just been formulated called SANERI. SANERI, South African National Energy Research Institute, which is going to look into developing renewable energy. So we have the strategy, although it is new, but it is already there and it is a government program. So we have to, the people have got to know that. Secondly, another member said here that the Germans they eliminated nuclear in favor of renewable, and so then it has worked in Germany. They've got it. It's not true. The Germans actually, they are the second investor, biggest investor out of 14 countries in that fusion project, nuclear fusion project in England. So people have got to know the information and facts, you see, when they come in. So the Germans have not abandoned nuclear. Yeah, although they are promoting the renewable strategy, energy strategy, as we are with SANERI in South Africa, they are also following nuclear, but on a different scale, which is fusion power now, which is a cleaner energy. So I wanted to make those points clear. Actually, another point which another member of the public was missed was that the jet project, the fusion power is an experimental thing for 50 years. No, it was experimental and it has now been finished at research. That is why the one that is going to Geneva is going to be the first experimental fusion power reactor producing energy for consumer purposes. So I think we must clarify those issues. Now, coming back to your input, statistics, especially on uranium contamination in that area. That is what I wanted to say. It is the statistics against which, are there any comparative statistics? Because it's one thing when I go with a certain attitude there and develop statistics and compare, say, this is the statistics, that organization which has put together, combined that statistics, who are they? What parties and directions they represent? So these are the things that you have to check up in Parliament when you come. Yet it's informative if you have statistics like that, which from which we can develop. That's the first one. Second, what is the source of accumulation of that? Is it because of industrial activity, or is it a natural accumulation because of the radioactive nature of these isotopes, radioactive isotopes like uranium? I just want to find out what exactly is the source of that accumulation. The third point, I think you have raised very interesting questions, which I think have been picked up by the member here. That is, Mr. Foray said he has no, they have no, they have no role in matters which belong to energy, because unfortunately nuclear energy belongs to LNR and them. But there it is now. They actually, I that's why I quoted it, because I use the act logic, because it quotes an number that in Environmental Management Act. I knew that it touches them directly to supervise these issues. And indeed, that you have now quoted, I have the paper that I did, and I was trying to look for the paper that I have, but now I didn't bring it here, but unfortunately we brought it. So he is directly, actually, answerable or accountable to what we've just said. So I think, therefore, the chairman of Environment Committee at least must really coordinate what that information that we have to Mr. Foray, so that they must come with answers to that. I know for one that there was another street in next to Falpex where the radioactive waste was found lying around there, and nobody wanted to be accountable. And therefore, you just wanted to find out why, where is there for the environmental regulator, you see. So these are the facts that are very important for the chair to convince us here. The other point that I wanted to raise is that how far does DIT and NNR coordinate these activities? Because according to the act that of course, like the MPRDA, I know because I also happen to be in, we were part of the people who formulated that act under NH. So I know that it doesn't directly, they have DIT and NNR have got to work together to get those things in correct order. How far do you interact with them or probably, I don't know, maybe it's a question of Mr. Foray to answer, but that's still some of the things that we have to look into. Finally, I think the members here have quoted to it. There is a problem of power relations. You are a member of public, you come like this, you know, there is this giant company, they are not here, and in fact, you'll find that today, it's just going to end up ourselves talking like this. They tell you, some of them, that there's nothing they can do because they discuss with senior people and ourselves. I don't know. But I think that's a very unfortunate circumstance. Thank you very much.
I think that quite a number of questions. Chairman, can I just add that? Okay, Mr. Blanche, raise your hand in time. Mr. Chairman, I want to congratulate the lady who came here today, because I think she not only gave us an excellent presentation, but she also smashed two myths. One is about ladies and the input they can make, and the other one is about blondes. Thank you very much. We enjoyed it. But I think, Mr. Chairman, we must really take action, because one of the entities reporting to the Science and Technology Portfolio Committee is the Human Sciences Research Council. And they must now be asked to verify all the allegations that was made, so that we as a Science and Technology Portfolio Committee can address it and see what is happening and come back to Parliament with a report saying that these are the findings we have researched, and the Human Sciences Research Council, these are the solutions they give. Therefore I want to really commend you on what you have done today. You have made a major breakthrough, first of all for the public and then for ladies.
I wish first of all to thank you for your very kind and unmerited compliments.
With regards to your question, what do? I'm an ordinary person. I've raised four children. I'm an unaffected person. I've never been a resident in the area that I refer to, the Bonnefontein Strait area. But I come from a long line of jurists. My father was a judge. I also have training in law, although I cannot practice as an attorney. My main objective is not to be a greenie. It is rather environmental justice. And environmentalism and social justice are indivisible. And that is the reason why I feel myself motivated. I do not receive a sponsorship or a salary at present. I have for the 7 years of this labour, which was argued, have not received one cent. It was all funded from my own personal funds. With regards to awareness creation, the lady asked me the question. At the moment, there has been no awareness creation amongst the population group. So, since my son owns a computer graphics company, we designed a brochure, which I then went with one of the EarthNow members, Mr. Mashile Talani, to Bekkersdal. That is how we commenced it, in order to distribute it to the residents. We also, subsequent to that, in my personal capacity, I went every weekend to distribute it amongst the population group. I wish to reiterate, it was not to create hysteria, but persons have the right to know that they are exposed to hazards or risks. Whether it is only foreseeable or not, we cannot tell. Because since at this stage, notwithstanding our repeated request, there has been no health risk, that it is epidemiological studies done to quantify the health risk. I have in my possession three historical academic treatises or papers that have been prepared by Professor Elise van Eden of the Northwest University, in which there appears an abundance of anecdotal evidence concerning cancers, especially pancreatic cancers and mental retardation amongst the population groups. It is of interest, however, that the Northwest State of Environment report issued by the department in 2002 did acknowledge this very fact. I can verify all of that, and I think this is a question that you raised concerning the statistics. The statistics were, this is one of many studies. It in fact started in 1960 with the Jordan Commission report, where under the apartheid regime, it was found that the profits that the gold mining had brought to the apartheid government, as well as to the gold mining industry, were justified the ecological destruction of the Bonnefontein Strait catchment. It resulted in massive sinkhole formation subsidence. It was foreseen in highly contaminated water resources, that is groundwater, aquifer, and surface water. Therefore, it was foreseen and that path was embarked upon. Subsequent to the 1960 Jordan Commission report, we had many reports. I have at my place where I sit a list of all these reports. The only matter that can be contested is the disclaimer which the National Nuclear Regulator stated concerning the radiological carcinogenic health risk quotient, because they claimed the methodology was based not on international methodology but on the United States Environmental Protection Agency's methodology. It never disclaimed the findings of this report. It did not disclaim the chemical toxicity risk of uranium contamination. It did not disclaim the high concentrations of uranium in the fluvial sediments and the water of the Bonnefontein Strait. So for all intents and purposes, we can accept this to be truthful and factual because no contrary evidence has been adduced thus far. You also asked concerning the natural background uranium concentration. It is high in background uranium concentration, and I have heard that one of the gold mines yesterday because a fast launch program will appear on the 1st of July concerning this issue, refuted the allegations of uranium contamination by stating that there are already high levels of uranium in the background, but does this justify the increase of even more uranium concentration? If a person is aware that there is already high levels of uranium contamination, should there not be a greater duty to care, in other words, to take a precautionary measure not to increase those levels of uranium? What I have referred to has no relevancy to background uranium. I simply related to you the statistics related to the uranium concentration caused and perpetuated by one single industry, the gold mining industry. Uranium is a byproduct of gold. Then you ask whether gold mines will ever respond to this. This I wish to mention. I trust that it is not mere lip service or greenwashing. In my labour, I have also engaged with gold mining companies, particularly Gold Fields, and lately also with Harmony Gold. They have now on Facebook put down remediation initiatives. They have accepted the responsibility and the liability. Gold Fields, in fact, has initiated the Warbonne contained strike action group, since they perceived the Department of Water Affairs to be tardy in the implementation of a forum. They have also appointed a consultant, Vision Africa, to advise concerning remediation initiatives, because this is a very complicated matter. Harmony Gold is also at the moment cooperating in these efforts. So I do feel that we have not only named and shamed, but there has been a process that follows from that can lead to a solution to this problem. Wetlands creation, for example, is one of the solutions that has been proposed. The CSIR and also the Northwest University are all cooperating in looking for initiatives or remediation solutions to this problem. I hope I've adequately addressed the question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brink. I think that certainly this portfolio committee will be in touch with you. We know what you've raised about this particular area in the Northwest. Certainly, I think it's incumbent upon us to make a visit, to go and meet with the committees and the people to express, settle our support, but also to explore what other remedial initiatives can be taken. Thank you very much for a very informative and humiliating
presentation. I just respectfully interpose. I have here about 9 or 10 just it's a document with the recommendations of this report, as well as my presentation and my recent letter to the Honourable Minister of the Department of Water Affairs. Thank you very much.
Unfortunately, in the matter of the public hearing, we do not clap, but I think the presentation like this deserves a clap. Go on and let Mr. Dominic Gilbert, or Ms. Dominic Gilbert, come over.
Thank you. It would be quite interesting to hear what it says in terms of what the last presenter said before you could let him go away. So it would be very, very interesting to hear if he has any, you know, thing to say.
Thank you, Chief. I did indicate at the beginning, and it's also on one of the slides that you have, that the Department of Environmental Affairs does have a role where it concerns pollution. If it is something that is not directly under the jurisdiction of one of the other departments, it is there on the slide. What I focused on when I spoke about the procedure and where our role is limited is within the EIA process, and I took great pains to try and explain the two parallel EIA processes. Pollution in general and pollution like this is certainly something that concerns us very much. I was going to talk to the lady afterwards if I get the opportunity to get more information from her. We as a department can get that information. We certainly will do whatever we can within our means to follow that up. Please, I'm very concerned about the impression that's been created that we try to wash our hands in matters environmental and environmental degradation. That is not the case. Thank you.
We look forward to an update on that interaction, Mr. Bori. We look forward to an update to ourselves on the interaction we will be having with Michael different officer. Over to you, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of this committee. It is from the bottom of my heart that I say thank you for calling this, these hearings. It's something that we as environmentalists and people who are concerned and involved in researching these issues have been trying to get information across to people and wanting something like this, a forum or a nuclear summit to handle these kind of issues. I think you're probably getting the picture already today that there is just such a magnitude of issues involved in the overall picture here. With the full fuel cycle of nuclear energy, starting with uranium mining, and although Marietta is a very hard act to follow, but certainly she's dealing with one mining industry, but the uranium mining industry is the predominant supplier for nuclear energy. I will try to address some of those issues in the time that I have available, but I do think that the entire complexity with the abundance of research and information that we do have available would best be dealt with in a much more in-depth forum. I would like to introduce myself. I am with the Pelindaba Working Group, which I consider that I basically live next to what I've come to consider the heart of the beast, the nuclear installation there. As a school leaver, my first job for 235 rand per month was working in environmental studies unit at Pelindaba. My tasks included having to collect samples that were taken back to laboratories and analyze the radioactivity in the environment. At that time, there was a fairly wide area around Pelindaba was being monitored. I believe that over the years, it's almost in a sense of a process of attrition, this has got smaller and smaller and less is being actually monitored. But nevertheless, during the course of working there, as a school leaver, I found out that cows had been irradiated, for example, and that irradiated milk, therefore, had been sent to Pretoria, and quite possibly thousands of people were drinking irradiated milk without knowing about it. I don't know what happened to those cows or what investigations happened or occurred. All I can tell you is that the public were never informed. I think that where I'm coming from today is the position of an ordinary citizen, and that I've become aware that these things do happen in the industry. We have, as a result of our work and our research and being involved in a community forum like the Pelindaba Working Group, been privy to a lot of information which is not always provable or backed up. I wish to make mention of some of it because I think that these things are backed up in documentation on studies done in other places in the world. These have not happened in this country from an environmental point of view or a humanistic point of view. And certainly, as has been pointed out here today, it is largely, we've had a sense of environmental racism that the underprivileged or the disadvantaged communities are the worst affected quite often by what has occurred. And this has happened all over the world. But just to bring to your attention some of the information, which I do admit we haven't been able to prove it, we don't always have a report for it, but we've been told that there have been mass deaths of fish and of birds along the Crocodile River, which flows into the Hot Vietport Dam. Now, the Hot Vietport Dam is, in any case, probably one of the most toxic in the world, and not simply because of what comes out of Nexa, but I can tell you that as a school leaver, I saw a practice that continues there to this very day. And what happens is that there is a thing called low-level waste, radioactive waste. It gets lined up in 44-gallon drums. Sometimes I've seen it as much as two or three rows on top of one another, and systematically poured into the Crocodile River. They are, including the National Nuclear Regulator, the Department of Water Affairs, and other environmental groups, this has been considered an acceptable practice, and we are being told that what is being emitted there falls within so-called internationally acceptable levels. I am aware of investigations that were started into the deaths of fish and birds, for example, where the people that were called in to look at this were absolutely horrified, but within no time, nothing came of the investigation because, of course, the polluter was the funder or the backer of the researcher at the time. This is very much the kind of information we are getting. I don't want to just be a scaremonger here. I'm telling you what I heard. We have also received information here of genetic mutations of animals that have been discovered in the Pelindaba area, and I think on the Nexa premises themselves, there are baboons there. There have been baboons born without four arms. There have been two-headed fish discovered, and I was told of an incident of a five-legged dog. Each one of these incidents, when uncovered, gets immediately taken off for scientific research. Nothing is ever heard from it. We have tried our very best to get evidence that I would have liked to present to you today. I can merely tell you what I've been told, and that was from people who lived there, were involved. You will later today hear about the health studies of people at Nexa, the Pelindaba complex. Much of the information is now coming out from people who have been occupationally extremely disadvantaged and now feel it is their duty to speak. I think that one of the main thrusts, we know that the devastating environmental effects of ionizing radiation, some of the chemicals that are used in the process of nuclear energy, the resultant nuclear waste, and the potential for contamination, particularly along transportation routes, and not forgetting the tailings that Marietta spoke about from uranium mining in particular, are overwhelming and incredibly well documented. Uranium is actually at the core of nuclear energy. It is the main source. There are various processes. I'm not a nuclear scientist. I'm not. I didn't go as far in as Marietta, but based on research which is out there, we find that what is coming out of the nuclear industry and people that they have co-opted to promote a nuclear plan constitutes a huge amount of propaganda. It is by and large unsubstantiated. And to take this a little bit further, as the Pelindaba Working Group, among others, have been involved in the so-called EIA processes, I have personally got involved in those in the latter stages for the nuclear fuel manufacturing plant at Pelindaba and the two smelter plants at Pelindaba. And I can tell you that, quite frankly, I am very horrified at the sort of responses that are given to members of the public as in terms of to answer concerns that are put forward in the EIA processes. These have to some, I'll just give you an example that in one response, for example, we were told that an aircraft crash into the Pelindaba facility would be of no environmental impact whatsoever. I think very few people would find that hard to believe. But the responses in these EIA processes have been flippant, sarcastic, if they are addressed at all. I wish to add that, once again, there are a limited number of people that ever find out about these EIA processes, and certainly the disadvantaged communities who are probably the most likely to be affected are not involved in them whatsoever. I have a few points that I would like to raise go a bit further on the cover-up of information that we have found. Bits and pieces are coming out. As time goes on, we recently uncovered a report that was written by Mr. Dani van Astronexa. We're not quite certain what the date on that is. We managed to pull it off the internet. But that quite clearly also states that there has been a excessive amount of radioactive radon, which is a uranium byproduct from decades of mining, that has got into the inhalation process, been inhaled by the entire Witwatersrand run community, and this has been for many decades now. Why I raise that is that we do have a thing like the Public Safety Information Forum. We try and take those issues up there, but we find that it really is pro-industry people that are there. It became very clear earlier this year. We had a public meeting for the Pelindaba Working Group, because it seemed as if nuclear power is now an unstoppable thing, irrespective of what the public feel and submissions that have been made in these processes, that they have just been greenwashed, and it felt as if nothing can be happening. So as a community, we decided to discuss issues of what are the implications of this. Of great concern is the issue that insurances and liabilities policies that are in place are so inadequate that it wouldn't cover it. We are told that there are countries internationally that have such stringent policies in this regard that they wouldn't even permit the transportation of uranium or radioactive waste through their countries because the fees would be so high. So we have a long way to go in that regard. We are also concerned of things like the ALARA principle, which is the as low as reasonably acceptable principle of the amount of contamination that the public may get, as opposed to what Marietta was talking about, a precautionary principle, which basically says that unless you know and fully understand the effects of what we're in for, not to allow it at all. So there are studies that we have, and I would be quite happy to make any of these reports available to honourable committee members, but that discuss issues like no dose. There is no such thing as a safe dose. No dose is a safe dose. The, for example, radiologist R.M. Sievert, after whom the radiation measure was named, himself said, and I quote, "There is no known tolerance level for radiation." Now, we're not being told that by our nuclear industry. In fact, some of them actually believe that a little bit of radiation is probably good for us. I think there is immense evidence that doesn't support that view. But to get back to our meeting of the Pelindaba Working Group to discuss issues of concern to communities most likely to be affected by developments in their backyard. And among these is also, of course, the issue of decommissioning. We believe that there aren't adequate, if any at all, decommissioning or cleanup budgets had not been even addressed, and yet our nuclear program is speeding ahead. But at this very same meeting, it was gatecrashed by the nuclear industry itself, NECSA, CBMR. In fact, probably half the people there were from this industry. And they literally, together with the Public Safety Information Forum chairman, who's supposed to represent the public, heckled so badly that this meeting couldn't really continue. It makes ordinary people like us wonder what is behind all of this. I do not want to really cover too much that other people will cover, so time permitting, I just want to touch on a few other points which I'd like to bring to this Honourable Committee's attention. And one is about uranium, another about uranium, that it is, in fact, an extremely dangerous to all forms of life, and it is often called a silent slow genocide. We're about to witness that in a great scale in this country if the uranium mining projects and nuclear energy projects continue on the scale that is being proposed. Marietta has covered Warner from Change Base, but the same report she referred to, in the Northwest Province alone, its 2002 State of the Environment report, states the following, and I'd like to read it. There is a growing body of evidence pointing that both the long and short-term effects of radioactive substances present in the environment may be impacting on the health of the population of the Northwest Province, particularly in the gold mining areas. Communities that are not currently supplied with safe treated water and which rely on radionuclide contaminated surface or groundwater resources for their potable water are the most vulnerable to such health risks. I wish to draw your attention to that to the five others listed in this report: Kokemoes Strait, Kromdraai Strait, the Wonderfontein Strait, which you've already heard about, Mooirivier, and the Vaal River, and Elandsberg. Have also been named in this report. We understand that the contamination of this underground water, there are reports on it, which we can make available to the committee, that the contamination is in fact endangering the whole of the Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site as well. I wish to add a little bit of information from the former NNR. CNS Council on Nuclear Safety in around 1999 put out a statement in terms of which it estimated that at that point at least 10,000 mine workers, or roughly 1 in 20, had been exposed to radiation levels that exceeded safety limits. They said in 1998, according to CNS estimates, 1,000 employees at Harmony Gold Mine alone were exposed to radiation levels that at some instances were 3 times higher than the annual dose limit of 20 microsieverts a year. At Nigel, workers were exposed to dose limits of up to 130 millisieverts a year, or 7 times higher than the allowable limit. In February this year, the NNR, in its submission on its annual budget to Parliament, or the Parliamentary Committee, I think it was, its CEO, Mr. Magumela, stated that in 2002, only 7,931 people had been exposed to unacceptably high doses. He added that this number had declined year by year to 1,133, then to 424, and then to 8. He considered this was an improvement over the last 5 years, but he failed to mention that over this period, uranium mining has virtually come to a standstill. The real problem, I don't think, has really even been addressed in any adequate way. Never mind the families, the communities, the orphans, the wives. I would be very happy to provide this community, this committee, with information on the health hazards of radioactivity. We are also informed through reports that we have that the day-to-day emissions under good circumstances from a nuclear installation, in fact, also emits ionizing radiation, which has long-term health implications for communities and people, and not within a 5-kilometer radius, as has been suggested by some in the nuclear industry, where evacuation plans only affect, in our area, 5 kilometers around Pelindaba. When the wind takes it, it could reach most of Johannesburg, Pretoria, and vast areas. I would like to finish off by asking this esteemed committee to please intervene on behalf of the citizens of this country. If there is any way that this portfolio committee could intervene and particularly give leadership in terms of rehabilitation and custodianship of our environment and of our very precious laws like NEMA, and therefore the Constitution, and therefore the communities who look to these laws for their protection. I ask this committee to please consider scrapping in its entirety the second amendment to the on EIAs in NEMA. It is in the process at the moment. And rather, to call for a full inquiry into nuclear energy that involves all stakeholders. Many of us are just ordinary people. There are people that are experts. And we base what we know on what we hear from them. Their opinions are valuable and imperative before this country goes nuclear in a full-blown way. I also ask that if there is any way in terms of which this committee could consider recommendations that do not allow the Department of Mineral and Energy to hand over mining licenses before environmental laws are in place to protect the health of people. And finally, I ask this committee to consider the severity of these submissions and the ones that you will hear today, and to try and influence and persuade other organs of state, if it is at all possible, namely Minerals and Energy, public enterprises, to reconsider. And science and technology, they're pumping so much money in there to train up people. These people could be used in rehabilitation. These people could be used in renewable energy. And in fact lead the world in that. So we would get our prestige out of that. I would like to end off with a quote, if I may, and I can't tell you who wrote it, but it says that human rights in the context of environment and sustainable development recognize that from human communities, for human communities to survive, they must have an adequate and secure standard of living. They must be protected from harmful substances and unsafe products. They must learn to conserve and equitably share natural resources. Without these environmental and public health policies in place, human rights for respect, dignity, equality, non-discrimination, and the ability for the public to participate in decisions that affect their lives cannot be achieved. Chief, I thank you very much.
What about that, sir?
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted some clarity. I wanted to find out if this low-level radioactive dumping downstream that flows into the Hartlepool Dam there, have you made the Department of Environment and Tourism aware of that? And if not, why not? And I'd also like to know that the people who are doing this, are they known to you people? That's just about what I'd like to know.
Before the other members come in, just to say that to correct Prodigy, lunch is ready, so that we can measure ourselves. And if you look at the program, we'll be ending here very, very late today. So that's just the second step.
Chairperson, four quick points. What's coming hot on the heels of Marie, I think the lady is Dominican. your presentation has been done to us and really has helped me particularly in this respect. Number one, I've always wanted to know where are the drums in Pelindaba. Some 15, 18 years ago, that red gypsies that disappeared. Actually, they were found in the township in Oxford B. And I've been explaining this, I served on this committee part of the 17, 13 years. Immediately, you know, moving out and going to other, etc. I could have been here about 7 years or so, half the time. And I've been persistently asking the nuclear, those responsible for nuclear, at Quebec and Alexa and so on, what happened to those drums? Because the children were found rolling and playing those drums in Atlas Field, 10, 15 drums. Now, and you know, everyone has been waffling, washing their hands, like the Pontius Pilate saying, no, we don't know what happened to the drums, etc., etc., what are they talking about? It doesn't even use the etc. So it has been shoved under the carpet. Now, those drums, the negligence of those drums, coupled with what you're telling us now, that, you know, the drums that are rolled down, the heritage is put down, is very, very horrifying. And, Chairperson, you must congratulate yourself and ourselves for having convened these public hearings. Honestly, because it's almost like, shit, I'm being born again, you know? Things that I've been born again. My eyes are being, my scales are falling from your eyes. From our eyes. Actually, it shows now, Mr. Fourier, the depth of the NEMA, that act that we passed is very, very germane, and we must make sure that it has got teeth already. To make it now, actually, that act actually bait. It must actually bite. It must really bite. Because, you see, if we don't, I mean, we've got all the tools, and we must just utilize them. And this amendment that's coming, we must make sure that actually, we have to look at it with the microscopic lenses. Now, finally, it's amazing how the energy things are intertwined with those of the other aspects of environmental effect and tourism. Like now, the total catch, the fish. Now, how, when the marine biology says that now our TAC is diminishing, we are actually killing the fish through radioactivity. Build something this side, use the power here, and destroy marine resources, whatever it should be. And I think, Chairperson, we must organize a special trip at the Portfolio Committee, over this trip, to Harker PS program, and again, when you must begin having and ask next year to have an account. Of course, I mean, it's just the remission of duty. There's no chance that we can allow this type of situation to develop.
Yeah, no, myself, thank you, Chair. I the lady talked about that there is a continuous training program for people in nuclear and the science and technology. I'm not sure, I mean, I think she must elaborate because I chair the Committee on Science and Technology. The information I have, actually, is totally contrary to what you are saying. The information which I received from people who were promised training in nuclear, they have not been trained. Yeah, those that have been trained, have been trained in very dummy things, useless things. The nuclear program of all these companies is actually run by consultants from outside, from Europe. So I've received a number of such complaints from the people who went there, who were supposed to be trained. Actually, if I can tell, one of them who went there was promised training and was never trained. So I have those complaints. I really know that they are valid because I was once there to promise training which never obtained. So I would very much like to get the data if you now have people that are being trained, but they have never been trained as far as I'm concerned. That's my question.
Actually, Aubrey has taken one of the questions.
maybe it's important not only to go to ask the BS but them, but to all these rivers that have been mentioned as you go around, so that you are sure. Secondly, have your issues been addressed or reported to the public health authority, so that they also form part of your support, and also verifying the data that we've seen so many people? And secondly, have you ever spoken with the Water Commission, because they're also dealing with issues of water, clean water and so forth, maybe to get their view and see how best they can support? Thank you.
I just want to look at the danger of nuclear waste. One of the experts, a fellow called James Lovelock, he argues here, in the document that was given to us as a background by John Ledger. I'm not sure whether John Ledger is here. I don't know the person. Yes. But I'm glad he submitted this question. He mentioned that the danger of exposure to radioactive material is exaggerated. And he mentioned, for example, that if you've been exposed to radioactive material, as people in Chernobyl or around Chernobyl in the Belorussia and in the former Soviet Union, that's a matter of weeks. If you were going to live for 60 years, 2 weeks, you'll probably forfeit 2 weeks. And unlike, for instance, unlike smoking. And then this guy apparently he established some of these worldwide environmental organizations. So, in the scientists, I don't know. What's your take on that? What is the evidence of the dangers of nuclear waste? I mean, is there enough evidence that indicates the longevity of people exposed to this sort of stuff?
Thank you. I will start with a question on Crocodile River. Certainly, environmental and affairs and tourism have been made aware of these issues repeatedly, and especially recently as a result of these EIA processes that have been underway. There has not been a single opportunity that environmentalists in the area haven't tried to raise these, and particularly with further nuclear developments on the cards, these have been dealt with at length. Who is doing it? It is most certainly Nexa. Before that, it's Atomic Energy Corporation. So this has been going on since about the 1960s. It continues to this very day. The same practice happens here in this area from Kuburg and releases into the Atlantic Ocean. It is considered a standard practice. The Pelindaba drums, I can't really tell you what happened there. We do know that there was on a Radiation Hill, so-called Radiation Hill scandal in about 96, and that was high-level radioactive waste. And these drums actually burst on the hill where they were being stored and released. They started leaking. I know that even the Nexa people themselves are concerned about it. They don't know to what extent this is. They will publicly say it's fine, but privately they will tell you that there is a likelihood of this waste actually having seeped into underground water supplies, and that they really don't know what to do with it or about it. And I think that really lies at the heart of the nuclear waste problem that every country in the world faces and hasn't been able to solve. I also welcome very much your statement that NEMA should really bite. It's our only hope. Program training, science and technology, we were informed by Dr. Rob Adam and various statements by, various statements that have come through that the intention is there for massive training. Rob Adam in particular has made statements that
there's a skill shortage. Money is going to universities, apparently, but I don't know. I do stand under correction there. So if it's not happening, it's even more worrying because we're told that there are massive maintenance problems and that there are no people to deal with them at these installations.
That's the second of the follow-up. Sorry.
Okay. Have we reported it to the public health authorities? Once again, I think this issue was shown, highlighted quite well as to when the department person was speaking here, that from a public point of view, there are so many, there is so much confusion about who really is responsible for what. You've got Water Affairs, you've got NECSA, you've got the companies themselves, you've got the regulators, and ultimately, often as a member of the public, we get sent from pillar to post. Letters do get written. We are then shunted to a regulator because they are mandated to protect the public. Marietta took 7 years to get through a meeting with a regulator. I have never had one reply from the regulator. So if that answers that question. Waste, the dangers of waste exaggerated. I think that from where I come from, having done an enormous amount of research, and I do try and read what the nuclear industry themselves put out. They certainly make it quite well known in the media, but there's an incredible amount of propaganda from where I sit that goes with the territory. There are views, of course, from both sides, but I think there is now an increasing amount of evidence about the effects of ionizing radiation, the effects of the dangers of waste. If one considers that Hiroshima and Nagasaki happened in the 40s, this is a fairly new industry in the world. I don't think that perhaps all of them knew what is likely to happen, but more and more of these evidences are coming out. I think that our finding is, and you may have this viewpoint repeated this afternoon, but the pro-nuclear lobby has a vested interest in making people believe their viewpoints. But and hiding the truth, and this is probably one of the saddest things about it. If you go looking for the truth, it is there, and the opportunity you've given us today, we thank you endlessly for.
Thank you very much, Madam. But we will go for lunch. But the chairman will ask for him to be able to come back again. Because I have a question on license. She made a statement that a mining license was easily transferred without getting an EI approval, environmental impact study approval. And I wanted to know where these mines were because I have come across similar incidents.
Okay.
Did you get that?
I have known that it is happening. There is another proposed amendment to the Petroleum and Minerals Act. It's a bill currently underway, which once again, like the second amendment on NEMA, it actually removes public participation and it puts the responsibility for the issuance of licenses straight into the department's hands of mineral and energy. So, yes. So, quite frankly, you could actually be sitting on a property, somebody else has granted mining rights, prospecting rights, and can begin mining almost without your knowledge or without your permission. They just arrive. So, we are informed of that more as an issue. Where it's actually happening right now, we don't know. We know that Magaliesburg area, which is quite close to where we live, up near the Hartbeespoort Dam, is one of the areas earmarked as a uranium resource area. And just before Christmas, notices were being put up everywhere. There was in fact one little notice that was almost unnoticed, stating that there would be an EIA process for uranium mining in the area. I know that most of that community has tried to register themselves as interested and affected parties. I certainly have done that as well because I live downwind from Magaliesburg. It would affect me as far away as Bruderstroom, where I now live. It is quite feasible that that's possible. And to this day, we haven't even had an acknowledgement of a registration as EIA, interested and affected parties.
Could I just put on record too then that the ERP and mine, their certificate has been handed over without an EIA, an impact study assessment. And many of the mines on in Ekurhuleni, like the Witwatersrand Gold Mining Company, their dumps are open for people to go and squat on. And there's probably about 40,000 people living on some of those dumps and in the region of those dumps. So we need to find out who the landowners are and what then can be done about it, because we are now exposing those people, those squatters, to the effluents and to all the dangers that previously they were not exposed to.
Thank you, Mr. Blanche. We will note this again to constitute part of our ongoing work. Can we be back at exactly at 2 o'clock? Thank you very much.
Please, the mind of the hand of the lances of the lay is being done.